This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, Kirsty Melville here with you, and this Anzac Week, Sister Blake's story from the First World War.
My great-grandmother always wore black, and my father knew it was a no-go topic. Maybe it was just too much sadness and unexplained endings.
People like Edie Blake, until now, were really just footnotes in the history of a tumultuous experience that left Australia with a generation of broken families.
Today, we hear the recently found letters of Edith Blake, a young Australian nurse who, when hearing of the start of World War I, was determined to go.
For many, their letter writing was almost a duty. They're detailed and insightful. So they could reveal their innermost feelings and their fears and hopes, and importantly, their emotions and reactions to daily events.
Sister Edie Blake's great-niece, Christa Vane Tempest, producer Ros Blewett, and historian Peter Rees bring us her story.
8 months after the start of the First World War, on Easter Saturday 1915, 29-year-old nurse Edith Blake said goodbye to her mother, father and two younger sisters, Grace and Queenie, at Cogra in Sydney's south. Queenie was Christa Vane Tempest's grandmother.
I grew up in a close family, but there was one topic that was rarely discussed, and that was my grandmother's elder sister, Edie.
Edie Blake was the only Australian nurse who died on active duty in the Great War.
Sister Blake leaves today for Europe as a staff nurse in the Royal Army Medical Corps. I can confidently recommend her for any position of trust. Matron Watson, Coast Hospital, Little Bay, Sydney.
The Coast at Sydney's Little Bay was a well-regarded training hospital for nurses and later became Prince Henry. Many of the nurses there put up their hands as soon as World War I was declared. No one anticipated the horror, length of time or the dangers ahead. First-hand accounts are rare, but letter writing became a comforting pastime for many of the nurses and kept them connected with home. And luckily for us, some of these letters have been kept under lock and key for decades. Christa Vane Tempest's family made their discovery a few years ago.
So sometime after my grandmother died, I found out about Edie's letters home. Turned out that for many decades, my grandmother had quietly kept safe nearly 140 letters that Edie had written home from the war. There were hundreds of pages. All of a sudden, someone who had just been a name started to become a person, and I could hear Edie's voice.
Dear Mum, Dad, Grace and Queenie.
My grandmother was Edith Blake's youngest sister, Queenie.
We left Melbourne 3 p.m. Tuesday and ran into a storm, but we seemed to run quickly out of it.
It's really emotional. It's really special having the actual letters in your hand because you know that you're touching the pages that she touched.
We shall get no more mail till we reach London, which will be about the 14th of May. Bid a long farewell to Australia. Wonder if... when we will return.
Sister Edith Blake never returned. Edie and her Coaster Sisters, as they were known, had got nursing posts with the British. Excited about seeing England, the Sydney nurses caught a train to Melbourne to board their ship, the Malwa.
Waiting lists were long, and this resulted in the decision of at least 130 nurses to short-circuit the wait and sail to England to join the British equivalent, the Queen Alexandra's Imperial Military Nursing Service.
I went on deck and promenaded till 9 p.m. Dr. Yates came and chatted to me for about an hour. He came over from the first class. He says it is too swanky for him.
Several of the Coast Hospital doctors enlisted, as well as many of the nurses. Edie was given a cabin with a nurse she'd never met, Evelyn Swanell.
Sister Swanell is my friend here. So far, she is a jolly good one. Full of life, fun.
And they got on really well, and they were soon inseparable.
Today, had a very nice game of deck quoits. I'm not too bad a hand at it, but still, I am not good.
What Edie and her compatriots wouldn't have known was that while they were sailing through the Indian Ocean on their way to what they thought would be disembarkation in Britain, that in fact the campaign at the Dardanelles was underway and that she would not be going beyond Egypt.
The nurses had left Australia thinking that they were going to England. It wasn't until they were almost docking in Suez that they were told about the attacks at Gallipoli and that they were going to stay in Egypt.
April 29th, 1915, Suez. We all felt as if a thunderbolt had descended upon us. Everyone is disappointed. I felt it too. The instructions are that we are to proceed to Heliopolis, a hospital in Cairo.
Egypt at the time was a British protectorate, and thus it was the base for British operations at the Dardanelles. In Cairo itself, we had number one Australian General Hospital, which was established in the former Heliopolis Palace Hotel, and tent wards were established outside this hospital.
We arrived at the Palace Hospital at midnight. The building is really the finest building I have ever seen. I've been lost twice in it already. There are about 800 patients and four nurses. You couldn't imagine what it was like and how the nurses welcomed us.
The Gallipoli campaign had been going on for about a week, and the wounded from there were just pouring into Cairo.
There is no base hospital near the Dardanelles. Trainloads upon trainloads of patients come in, till they brought in 350. In the ward I'm in, there is not one whole man. They each have either leg or arm missing. Some have shoulder shattered as well. When I see eyes taken out, legs amputated, you wonder what sort of existence these poor men will lead as time goes on. You don't know how thankful I feel that we haven't a brother. To see these poor mangled men would make one's heart ache. I've been in heavy wards and seen heavy cases, but never to equal this, nor so many.
The wounds they were dealing with were wounds that the nurses had not really been prepared for. These were war wounds.
And at that point, it got real.
The very bad patients are at Alexandria. Most of the nurses are anxious, as they have brothers at the Dardanelles.
There was a direct line for convoys to bring back the wounded to Alexandria, and then from there to take more wounded onto Cairo.
The day orderlies stayed up till 1 a.m. Several patients got up and helped, and how we all worked. On Tuesday, a cablegram was read out to the patients from the King, congratulating them on their bravery in the peninsula of Gallipoli near the Dardanelles.
The medical facilities were completely basic. They were very utilitarian. They had to use kerosene tins for washing the patients. Such was the shortage of equipment.
Edie's youngest sister, my grandmother Queenie, had applied to start her own training as a nurse at Edie's Coast Hospital. This thrilled Edie.
Well, Queen, what would you think we would be doing in an operating theatre? Sometimes, when opening into a cavity in the body, a rubber tube is put in to take away pus or matter, which is injurious. These tubes are something like a garden hose, some almost as big, and grading in size to so small a tube that a needle can hardly pass. The tubing is boiled and kept in boiled water or some antiseptic.
And such was the pressure that they had to set up the operating theatre in a ticket room that measured 4 by 3 metres with mosquito netting on the walls to try and keep flies out.
The inside of the tents have boarded floors, but the outside is heavy sand. Walking from one to another is worse than walking on Manly beach sand. It makes me so tired.
They didn't know how long they were going to be in Cairo, so they were determined to see and do as much as they could.
May 1915, Cairo. Had a glimpse of the Nile yesterday for the first time.
When they had a half day off, they'd walk for miles across the desert, so you can imagine they're in their ankle-length uniforms trudging through the hot sand into the city centre.
We went 4 miles up the Nile and visited orange groves. The perfume of the orange blossom was delicious. I didn't want to come out. You have seen pictures from the Bible, haven't you? Well, these people dress in the same way. The peacefulness of the scene, the dress of the Arab, made one feel the ancient things. It was hard to realise war was going on.
Travel at that time was a rarity, and the nurses were suddenly finding themselves in the lands that they'd only read about. And so to be there was something that just filled them with awe and wonder.
They're just seeing everything in front of them for the first time.
The pillars of stone are wonderful by day, but awe-inspiring by night. I wouldn't for all the world have missed this trip. It is an education.
Edie also bought herself a small camera in Cairo, and among her letters, there are a few faded black and white photos.
We'll send you a photo sitting on a camel in the shade of the Sphinx. A weird experience it is, riding one. Wish you could see it too. For I shall never forget this place as long as I live. Love to you all, from Edie.
After they'd been in Cairo for 2 months, the coast nurses, and they called themselves coasters, were sent to British hospitals in Alexandria.
The journey up, or rather down, to Alexandria is very pretty. All the banks of the Nile are cultivated. We crossed and recrossed the Nile many times. For dinner, we went to a hotel called Beau Rivage, which means beautiful beach. We are right on the Mediterranean Sea.
Alexandria was the first port of call from the Dardanelles. The scenes in Alexandria were totally frenetic with this sudden and unforeseen influx of wounded.
25th of June, 1915. We arrived at hospital, 4 p.m.
Edie was quite happy to go to Alexandria because she seemed to enjoy the more challenging nursing work, and I think she was pretty good at it. She definitely wasn't squeamish.
Sister Swanell and I are at the 17th British General Hospital. Matron allotted our places. Mine was the upper theatre. Strange that I should be sent to the theatre. I was so glad I had experience of the theatre at the coast. Today I've seen 10 operations for one theatre. The orderlies get the theatre ready and also clear it away. The sister helps the surgeon. Big operation in morning. Excision of rectum. Commenced 10 a.m. Finished 1 p.m. 2 operations this afternoon. Further amputation of left humerus. The second was emphysema. Just as I was going off duty, cellulitis. Went to dinner. Called back on duty 9 p.m. Mastoid operation.
That's where she saw the really confronting stuff.
The Dardanelles must be a large shamble, for the wounds are frightful. We have about 1,700 patients now in hospital number 17. 10,000 men are expected next week, some telling me that they are going straight to the Dardanelles. It makes one's heart ache to see these men going, wondering how many will return.
When the casualties mounted, the light horse was sent as dismounted troops. So Edie certainly would have seen them going off.
Almost all the boys waved us goodbye.
And they would recognise the accent and shout out, "Hello, Australia," and they'd treat each other as family almost.
The boys were very cheerful, singing at the tops of their voices. "Are we downhearted? Tipperary?"
To have this Australian identity gave them this closeness to home. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.
Edie had her 30th birthday in Alexandria, but there was little time to celebrate. She did, however, get her usual bundle of letters and belated newspapers from home.
When I get the Sydney Mail, I pass it round to the Australian boys, and any Gallipoli pictures they describe and make it very interesting for me. I do not know what we would do without them. They are so much brighter than the British. Don't think that I've lost my heart to any of them. I'm afraid they all range between 20 and 22 years old.
The troops saw the nurses as surrogate mothers who would write to their families back home as they sat by the bedsides. These women became family members almost, getting messages of love back to their mothers and family in Australia.
The nicest of all in my ward now is a Melbourne boy who knows how to describe things on the peninsula. I could listen to him all day long.
She's clearly intelligent. Just the things that she mentions that she wants to read and the fact that she wants to have proper conversations with people. You know, she's not very interested in small talk.
In the ward, I can please myself whether I talk to the men or not. But outside of the ward, when a man's company is thrust upon me, I find it often a distinct displeasure.
Edie was apparently set up with a lonely British officer on one of her afternoons off, which didn't go down too well.
I'm afraid I'm doomed to the solitude of an old maid. Never mind. So far, the life of an old maid is anything but unpleasant. But of course, I cannot tell what life will present in another 10 or 15 years.
The Australian nurses quickly established themselves as among the most competent. Their training through the work of Lucy Osborne, who'd come to Australia in 1868 to bring the Florence Nightingale system of nursing after the Crimean War, really stood them in very fine stead.
Both matron and the doctors give Australian nurses unstinted praise. They say to us that they think we know how to work and to pioneer. Matron says she wishes she had more Australian nurses.
They brought with them an independence and an ability to be practical, to have a nous that allowed them to work independently, to make decisions which freed up doctors.
Do not expect a letter next mail, nor perhaps the next, for it may take a fortnight to bring the wounded back, for they are expecting a big slaughter at Achi Baba, that hill at Gallipoli that is to be taken at all costs. On Thursday, the heat was terrific, 122 degrees in the shade. I pitied the poor patients. My belt buckle badge and studs all seemed to burn, and if we went into the sun, our clothes seemed to scorch.
Edie had now been away from home for over a year, and it was usual for nurses to be moved on every 6 months. But this didn't seem to be the case for the Sydney coasters in Egypt.
There seems to be no good news from Gallipoli. All the hospital ships have returned heavily laden with wounded. So I suppose we shall remain in Alexandria for a long time to come. It is now frightfully hot and muggy. Some of us told Matron we would like hospital ship duty, either to England or Dardanelles.
There were no facilities on the beaches at Gallipoli. The hospital ships were indeed the hospitals.
On board hospital ship, we will only get £40 per year, but we're anxious to see a little more of the world. I would like to move on.
They saw working on the hospital ships as a way to get to England and France eventually.
I want to see everything I can. Swanell and I are to go together.
And 6 months later, they got the news they'd been hoping for.
Dear Mum, Dad, Grace and Queen, Matron sent for me to tell me I was to go on the hospital ship Essequibo next Friday. Swanell is to go too. We may not go straight to England, but we'll probably go to Salonika and Malta. Hope you people are not anxious about me. Being a hospital ship, we are very safe. We are all prepared for emergencies. I feel that nothing will happen to us. If an accident happens, we are to go to our wards, if we have patients, and help them with their belts. There is a special belt for me in the ward. Then I have to wait orders.
The smaller hospital ships generally stayed closer to the theatre of operations in the Aegean and the Mediterranean.
There are two minesweepers guarding the opening to let us through.
Minesweepers were necessary outside the major ports. German U-boats were operating within those areas and ships were being sunk, including in the Mediterranean.
So she was aware of ships going down in the Mediterranean because she did warn her parents because she just told them she might be going off on transport. And then the next thing, this ship went down.
The troop ship Marquette was torpedoed and it sank. There was a loss of 167 lives, and among those who died were 10 nurses. And this sent shockwaves through the nursing contingents.
She would have heard about the 10 nurses that were lost with the Marquette, but she didn't say anything about it. She didn't want to worry her parents, I don't think. She reassured them with stories of her boat drills, and they knew she could swim. I suspect she did have some niggling fears.
6th of October, 1916. This is our first day on this ship. She will probably be my home now till April next. I can neither mention names of places or conditions of patients. I can't say things on the sea are not interesting. They are, but I cannot write about them. But I can cherish my memory and unburden it when I see you all. We were allotted our wards. I was given the officer's ward. It was rather strange the way Matron looked around us all and said she wanted one for the officers who would be firm and not fuss. I was chosen, much to my astonishment. When we were amongst the islands of the Aegean Sea, the terrible news came that the hospital ship Britannic had been torpedoed. We all seemed numbed at the news. Somehow, when one is on the sea and passing through all dangers without a hurt, we are inclined to feel that we are always safe. The boys who have been at the front tell us the same thing. I must close now. Hope Mum and you all are well. Much love from Edie.
It's really emotional. It's really special having the actual letters, if she's tired or anything like that, just from how she's writing. You know, is it more loopy? Is it a jumping a bit because she's on a ship and the ship's pitching and rolling?
I do hope in April that they will dump us in England and not back in Alexandria.
And you even get a feeling for how she's feeling just from how she's writing.
While you are sitting on the veranda admiring the sea, you can imagine me on a wintry sea and enjoying it. After 18 months of Egypt, I wonder what is in store for us. Goodness knows where I shall be when you get this letter. Love from Edie. I wonder where I shall spend next Christmas. Maybe at home?
And then in January 1917, it was back out into the Mediterranean, and this time they're on their way to England.
Finally, Gibraltar, then England. 25th of January 1917. Somewhere near the Isle of Wight. in England at last. I never experienced such cold before. I went up on deck and went for a promenade walk. My hands and face felt as if they had been flayed with tiny whips. The wind was so sharp and keen.
So, nearly 2 years after she'd left home, my great-aunt Edie had made it to England at last. In the Atlantic, it's rougher ocean. And Edie coped with the rough seas better than her friend Swanell.
Swanell has been too sick to stand it, so as to be put off in England into a hospital. I have asked too to come off, as it is nearly 6 months since I came on the sea.
Edie and Swanell hatched a plan and they decided to go to the War Office in London to see the matron-in-chief of all the Queen Alexandra's nurses, Miss Ethel Beecher.
We saw Miss Beecher, the matron-in-chief. She was in a fearful temper. When I stated my request to leave the ship, she snapped my head off and asked me if I would like her to arrange my private affairs for me.
Miss Beecher was extremely angry to be interrupted and to have two young Australian nurses just turn up on her doorstep without so much as an appointment. And she pretty much told them that, "No, I will not be making special arrangements for you."
Swanell and I had to part, and I came back to Liverpool and she went to Scotland.
Edie and Swanell, who'd been inseparable for over 2 years, were parted.
"Well, Queen, I do get very homesick. It doesn't seem as if war will end soon. In fact, I feel rather pessimistic. What a lot poor England has had to put up with."
After Edie's time on the transport ship Essequibo, she was sent to a prisoner of war hospital in southern England. 6 months later, she hoped she might get France to finally nurse Australian soldiers and see her friend.
In November 1917, Edie again asked for France. Evelyn Swanell, who was now there, had even put in a word for her, but still Miss Beecher wasn't giving her France.
Edie Blake and Evelyn Swanell would never see each other again.
"I asked for France, but I've got a hospital ship instead, and I'm taking it. I'm going to join the Glenet Castle at Liverpool. Please don't think of submarines. If my time to die comes, well, it comes, and it can't be helped. Though the thought of dying is far from my thoughts, I think I shall see Australia once more."
So Edie took the train north and joined the hospital ship Glenet Castle in Liverpool in November of 1917.
"This ship carries only 450 patients, but she is very steady and very seaworthy. Our cabins are situated in a very awkward position, very near a staircase. We have fire drill every week. While at sea, when going to bed, we put in readiness our coat and dressing gown, the sleeves of the latter inside the sleeves of the coat."
Sailing was a risky business, so it was necessary for the nurses to be given drills in the event of being shipwrecked.
"In the pocket of my coat, I have put several handkerchiefs, a pair of stockings, a silk scarf, and a flask of brandy."
Her family are probably worried that she's going back to sea again, and she was keen to reassure them of her safety.
"I wish there could be a telephone across the water, that I could ring 576 Cogra and have a good old talk."
On the Glenet Castle, there was a contingent of 8 nurses. They left Newport in Wales, making their way to France to pick up men wounded on the Western Front. In her letters, and bear in mind, these letters are written to her family, so she doesn't want to upset or scare them unnecessarily, but she's clearly aware of the dangers.
Well, during the war, the German High Command viewed Allied hospital ships as violating the Hague Convention, and German submarines were ordered to target them. This meant that many hospital ships were attacked, sometimes deliberately and sometimes as a result of mistaken identity. They were sunk by either torpedo, mine or surface attack, and they were easy targets.
She had mentioned the Forbidden Zone a couple of times. The Germans had undertaken not to attack hospital ships outside the Forbidden Zone. And that zone started at Land's End on the southern tip of England and continued through the English Channel around to the North Sea. The Red Cross and the green lights and everything on the Glenark Castle were brilliantly lit, clearly marked as a hospital ship. At 4 a.m, the deck crew were changing shift and the torpedo hit the Glenark Castle just as that was happening.
When a torpedo struck a hospital ship, it sent terror through the staff.
Immediately all the ship's lights went out, the wireless was disabled, so they couldn't send out any distress signals. The eight nurses on board would have all been in their bunks, probably well asleep when that happened. The ship was hit with a terrific thump on the starboard side. It started to list almost immediately as water started pouring in. And that meant that the people who were in cabins underneath were probably being tumbled out of their bunks. They're in absolute darkness. The ship is severely listing to starboard. And so floors that are coming at them sideways. So it would have been very difficult to move around the ship and actually find their way to the stairwells in the dark and to get on deck. It just would have been terrifying. As far as we know, the only lifeboats that came away successfully were launched from the port side. 153 died, and of those, we don't know how many actually even made it onto the deck to try to get into the lifeboats. Only one lifeboat survived the night, and in it were 22 men, some of the most experienced and strongest crewmen. They had to bail constantly through the night to avoid being swamped. Only one other lifeboat was found. An empty lifeboat was found the next day, bearing signs of life. It had boots and stockings wedged inside. So, you know, had someone been in it or preparing to get in it? We don't know. And we'll never know what happened to Edie. The last letter the family had from Edie is dated the 26th of January 1918. So that's a month to the day exactly before the Glenark Castle left Newport. Her beloved family would have received the devastating news shortly afterwards. And then a few weeks later, this last letter addressed to my grandmother Queenie, who's now at the Coast Hospital, arrived.
26th of January, 1918. My dear Queen, such a big mail I got. 14 letters in all. Two were from you, and one from Grace, and one from Matron Watson. She has asked me to call on her sister in Stirlingshire in Scotland, and when I go to Scotland, as I hope I shall one day, I shall certainly go and see her. Stirling is one of the places I wish to see. Matron was telling me how large the staff has grown. In your letter, you spoke of Ward 18, where I hear the floors are polished. Yes, they would be hard on the feet, I should think. We have started on our way back to England. I will write home as soon as we get to Avonmouth, or wherever we land, unless we strike a torpedo instead. Give my love to all the girls who know me. I hope Mum is quite all right now. I wonder how long it will be till I come back to dear old Coast. Much love, from Edie.
So, yeah, I wonder what her last thoughts would have been. I don't know. What would your last thoughts be? Probably of her family. I think at least at the last, she was with her friend Rose Beresford. She wasn't alone, but it's just so sad to think she was only 32.
Before the Great War, Australian military nurses had been seen mostly as glorified first aid workers. But by war's end, it was clear that their contribution had been not only professionally competent, but crucial to the war effort.
I think finding her letters and putting them and her photographs into print, I think it honours her life and her work.
That terrible war is seen as the emergence of Australian manhood and mateship, but the role of nurses such as Edie Blake, at the front has been mostly overlooked, not being granted their rightful place in our nation's history.
It is Edie's story, but it's also a tribute to all of the nurses of World War I.
Sister Edith Blake was produced by Ros Blewett, with sound design by John Jacobs. Thanks to Krista Vane-Tempest and to historian Peter Rees. And if you'd like to read more of Edie's letters home, Krista's book, Edith Blake's War, is available now, and you can find all the details on our webpage. I'm Kirsty Melville. Thanks for your company. See you next time.
I wish there could be a telephone across the water, that I could ring 576 Cogra and have a good old talk. Perhaps one day we may be able to talk by wireless. Love to you all, from Edie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.